I'll tell you a little story here. Can you guys hear me okay? Okay. This is a picture of Mount Baker. It's North Cascades. And so I was up there a couple weeks ago, and I was looking at this peak over here, which is called El Dorado Peak. It's one of my favorite climbs up there in the North Cascades. So I took a closer picture of it. I was on an adjacent peak. And I thought that looked pretty cool. It wasn't until I got home that I zoomed in and realized that there were actually 7 people just climbing to the top of that peak, which I thought was pretty cool. You can kind of see the 2 rope teams on their way up. So this is what we're going to be talking about today, which is basically, how do we take the mass of data that is in front of us and find the story, the insight that is inside of that data? So we're going to go into let me back up then. So I'm Lance Olson. I'm a group program manager inside of here in the big data team at Microsoft, and working on Cortana Analytics, the big data portions of Cortana Analytics. So pieces that you heard touched on in the kickoff sessions today and the keynotes. Really 3 areas we're going to talk about. So we'll drill into big data as part of Cortana Analytics. This is a 2-part session. So this first part will actually go through all the pieces that make up the big data offerings, how they fit together, what the most common use cases are that we see today. And then the second session, which is from 1 to 2, we'll actually do hands-on writing applications. And the intent there is to show you what you would need to walk away from here being able to go get started programming, building solutions with these services. So this first round is an intro. The second hour is a deep dive. Let me ask a couple questions to get started, though. First off, who here has used Hadoop? Okay, actually that helps me a lot in terms of how much time I'll spend on different pieces. about 50%, it looks like. So we'll drill into each of the components that are in the system and how they fit together. Feel free to stop and raise your hand. We have Mary Ellen is helping with the microphone, so we'll bring a microphone to you. If you have any questions, just let me know. We can take questions as we move along. All right, so first, basically we want to talk about the importance of data. So we know that data is critical for all of us. It is how we get, it's the mass that we use to get the insight. And for a long time, we've been using data for static reporting. Basically, how many widgets were sold this week? How many customers came in last week? And we're pretty used to this type of reporting and this type of analysis on top of data. Next, we look at why did it happen? You know, this many were sold this way, or things went up in this region, so they went down in that region. What's the correlation there? But increasingly, and that allows us to take decisions. Increasingly, though, we're wanting to ask questions like, well, what's going to happen next? And that one's a little harder. You can't actually foresee the structures in the data, or even sometimes the data you're going to need to answer that question. So that question is actually part of what's been driving the shift towards the big data technologies. It's how do I ask that question if I don't know up front when I create my schema, when I create my data warehouse? Then we get to harder questions like, what am I going to do? What happens if I do this? What will happen in the system? How will my customers behave if I change my offering in this way, my product? And that is what gets us closer to action. It's how do we create data that will drive our decisions? And so we see that those requirements on data are actually driving, those questions we want to ask of the data are driving a change in the characteristics of the data that we use. We started out with data that was relatively small, relatively well-structured. And what we've seen is continued growth in the data, but also an increase in the complexity of the data that we work with. So data is now, in order to answer the kinds of questions that we want, the data spans a wide range of complexity and size. It's not just about volume, though. It's also about the speed of the data and the shapes. Okay, so I asked about Hadoop. So just a brief primer on Hadoop. I believe some of the key drivers for Hadoop were the commoditization of storage, low-cost storage, and low-cost compute. And that actually has allowed us to shift the data processing systems from the traditional relational model where we scale up, and if you want the database to go faster, you tune it. And if you're done tuning, if you've tuned everything you can do to the database, then you buy bigger hardware and you scale it up as high as you can to get it to go as fast as you can. Hadoop takes kind of the opposite approach. It's a scale-out approach. It says, with commodity hardware, we want to brute force. We have the ability to brute force our way through a lot of questions. That power gives us flexibility. Things like schema on read, which means you don't necessarily have to commit to an optimized schema for your data processing system. You can actually define schemas as you go, and if you have enough compute to throw at it, you can still make it go reasonably fast. So that's one. Those are two key drivers, and then the other one is the availability of the software. You know, even today, distributed parallel processing of data is not easy. And we'll talk about things we've done to make it easier, and we continue to do more to make it easier. But it's still fundamentally a difficult problem. And systems like Hadoop have actually helped substantially to simplify that problem. So you can actually, we're now to the point that you can write a SQL statement, and you can have that execute on tens of thousands of cores. And that's pretty cool. You can do that without thinking about the cores. And the system will actually push that down. So it's designed to handle volumes of data. It's also a fundamental premise of Hadoop is this thing we call the data lake, which is this notion that instead of having all of the data in a silo that is coupled with the compute layer, so a particular store for my data warehouse, a different one for my machine learning, a different one for my batch processing. The idea with the data lake is that all the data goes into one place in its raw form, and then you bring different compute patterns to that lake and run that over the data. So instead of bringing the data to the compute, you're bringing the compute to the data. When the data gets really big, you have to do that because the laws of physics come into play and you can't move the data around. And that's the only way to really get decent performance. And so that's another fundamental tenet of the data lake and behind Hadoop. All right, so then why do we see people using things like Hadoop in the cloud? The most common answer that I see in terms of the customers I deal with for running Hadoop in the cloud is time to solution. We can create giant processing systems in a matter of minutes, fully configured and ready to go. We can tear them down in a matter of minutes. Elasticity is another key thing. You only pay for them while they're up. Storage and compute are separated in the cloud in this architecture, so you can actually have anybody who's getting into using big data tends to they expect to see growth in their data, and that's a common thing that I think all of us are experiencing as we take more components in our business and we connect them up to sensors and instrumented, whether it's an application or it's a device on the manufacturing floor. We connect these things up and they generate more data, so we know more data is going to be coming in. If we tightly couple compute with storage, that means that as our data grows, we have to buy more and more compute. Those don't necessarily grow at the same in the same way. You may actually just want to always be processing the last week's worth of data, but you might want to keep the last year or the last 5 years or the last 10 years. So having the ability to do this, grow these things independently is another key value proposition. Another one is the amount of capacity you can create, in particular for compute. I have a customer who's they create gigantic graphs. They actually work in the genealogy business, and they have a project where they've been creating a graph of the entire known recorded human history. So it's a tree of every record of every person who's ever lived on Earth, in as much as there are records. And so they have billions of nodes in this graph, and they want to be able to do fast lookups on the relations between anybody, you know? So we all can truly know exactly how close we are to Kevin Bacon, basically, is what we're trying to achieve, right? Processing that graph on their 200-node system in their own network took them about 8 months. One full computational cycle takes about 8 months. What they're trying to do is get that down to a few days. They're getting more than a million changes coming in, updates coming into the graph every day. And they want to be able to constantly update the tree, incorporate those changes as more records come online, and be able to continue to serve up the experiences they serve to their end users. That means you might want to, for a weekend, they might want to provision 10,000 cores to run over a job and compute a chunk of the tree. We can do that in the cloud, and when they're done, they don't have to pay depreciation on the hardware. They're done with it, they spin it down, and they move on. So that's another common motivation that I see for people using the cloud and Hadoop together. All right, so then this is the, you've seen the Cortana Analytics Suite overview slide in the keynote. So this is the You Are Here slide of this presentation. So the core areas we're going to talk about today are the Azure Data Lake and Azure HD Insight. And we'll drill into those and we'll go through and talk about what the details are behind those. All right, at this point I'll pause. Are there any questions so far in terms of what I've covered? Okay, great. All right, we'll dive in then to how these pieces fit together. So Azure Data Lake and HD Insight are the compute layers and the storage layers for the big data scenarios in Cortana Analytics. So as Hadoop, HD Insight is Hadoop, so it has a number of different processing patterns. It has batch, has scripts, SQL, unstructured data, NoSQL, streaming, in-memory data with Spark, all on top of the data lake. And you could also use it on top of blob storage. And it really depends on, I think over time, I believe everybody will want to just use it in the data lake, but the data lake is still in private preview today, so it's not available in every region. But over time, it is such a better solution that I think most folks will go to that. Blob storage has the benefit that it is ubiquitous. We'll talk about the trade-offs between those two a little bit later in the session here. All right, so what is HD Insight? It is a fully managed cloud Hadoop offering. It's 100% open source. It's exactly the same code that you get if you download the HDP distribution from Hortonworks and run it on-prem. Whenever we make changes to it, we actually check them back into the Apache trunk. So the reason we do that is we actually don't want to manage. I don't want my team to be responsible for a separate version of Hadoop. I spent 10 years working on .NET, the .NET stack, and I lived the joy that it was to make all those libraries work together before every release, and we would spend months aligning those libraries to ensure they were all compatible and that all the changes we made in them were all coordinated across the entire set. And I love the fact that there are distribution vendors out there doing that, and I don't want to do the same thing. So I also want everybody who uses the service to have the confidence that any code you write or any code you take from the ecosystem will run here. And that way, you can benefit from the tremendous momentum that is taking place in this ecosystem. So it's 100% Apache Hadoop. Now, one thing we do on top of that code is we have external instrumentation that actually monitors the applications running within Hadoop. So if Hive is misbehaving, as these things sometimes do, we actually will know about it and we'll go fix it. So we actually watch we have monitoring software that watches the behavior, the uptime of the applications. And If there are problems with them, we will fix them. We have a three nines guarantee on availability of your cluster. And so you can run the, use Hadoop and get the benefits of the ecosystem without as many of the headaches of configuring and maintaining, managing the system. And that's one of the core value props that we have in HD Insight. We partner closely with Hortonworks. We tend to track the releases normally by about 4 to 6 weeks. So one common question I'll get is, how far do you lag behind a new HDP update? We can go as close as we want. Sometimes we find it's actually good to have a little bit of time for that stuff to get out and bake a little bit before we put it in. But the main difference is when an on-prem release comes out, we then certify it. We together with Hortonworks run a whole bunch of tests over it to make sure that it runs effectively in the cloud environment. And so that typically takes about 4 to 6 weeks. Let's see. All right, I'm going to keep going. Any questions on HD Insight? Yeah.
So how does it manage the clustering of it? It has data stores and name nodes, right? In Hadoop, so you have one name node and multiple data nodes.
Yeah.
So in HD Insight, how is it managed? I understand that Azure is offered VM, right?
Yeah.
So each VM has one data node, and you have multiple VMs out of the background.
How do we represent clusters and nodes, and how can you control those in the context of this service? And so the way that we do that is when you go to create a cluster, you can select the cluster type. So you can choose a Hadoop type, which is basically you can put anything you want on it. We also have some specialized types, like a Spark cluster, that's really optimized for that workload. So you can either pick the one that's optimized for a specific use case, or you can pick the general one. And then within that, you can control, you could say, I want these types of VMs for my data nodes, these types for my head nodes. So you can say how many and what types you want. And so you can pick, if you're doing a job that, if you're gonna run a workload that is really memory intensive, then you can pick like a D12 VM type, which is a VM type with more memory. If you actually don't need the memory and you just want speed, you can pick a D3, which will actually cost you less and has less memory, but still runs as fast. So you have flexibility to mix and match the VM types to meet the workload that you use. And this is another thing we see with kind of the cloud versus on-prem. You can go build out your application, you can do your POC, and you can experiment with the different types of hardware characteristics. If you want SSD in there because you're gonna be hitting the disk a lot and you want speed in your workload, you can go provision VMs with SSDs. You can benchmark that and then tear that cluster down and create a new one that doesn't have SSDs, and you can say, all right, which one went faster? And so you could actually easily, without any investment that you have to make, you can test things like that out. Good question. Yeah? Yeah, so great question. Today we support blob storage. When will we support table storage and SQL? You can certainly use data out of table store and SQL, but as you said today, you have to use a tool like Scoop to move the data over. We also do have a built-in connector for DocumentDB, so you can actually push down queries to DocDB. We don't have plans right now to add built-in support for table storage or SQL. Where we're focused on for that is really our biggest focus in terms of the store layer is on the Azure Data Lake. And I'll talk more about the Data Lake in a minute, but that's what we're prioritizing, and I think when I get to it, you'll see why. But I do hear you on the dream that what we want to get to for all of this is that your data never has to move, right? It can all live. So it's really compelling to be able to connect to it in table storage. All right, I'm going to keep going. Okay. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time on the pieces here because about half of you raised your hand when I asked who has used Hadoop. But I will hit these components just enough so that everyone kind of gets on the same frame in terms of what the core components are. So the first one is Hive. So you can think of Hive as SQL for big data. This is, it looks a lot like SQL, behaves a lot like SQL. This is how you would write queries against your data. When you write the queries, the data can be anywhere. So the data can be sitting in the data lake, can be sitting in blob storage. You could have moved it from some other location and put it into blob storage and be processing it. So you specify the file location when you create a table in Hive. And that could be a text file, an XML file, a JSON file, whatever format you want. You can have a custom format, so you could write your own. If you had your own file formats, you could do that. And once you've basically told the system, that's my file, everything else will look like SQL. It will look like a table. So you'll say, create table. You'll put the names of your fields in, the types of your fields. And then you can just write your queries right over those fields. And that's what Hive does for you. So it really gives you a SQL experience. You can do joins across tables that span files. So, and one of the things that we've constantly, the holy grails we've constantly chased in the database world is distributed query. Because there's always that other piece of information somewhere else that you say, if I could just join this, I could get that new, key insight into my business. Well, that's what the data lake and the approach that Hive takes, where you can map any kind of file into the system and then do queries and joins over it, allows you to do. It's not actually pushing queries out to disparate systems because the data all gets moved into the data lake. But you can work with disparate data. You couldn't really do that nearly as well in a relational store because you would need to optimize the data. So this is where that brute force element of the scale out compute really comes in handy. All right, then the next one is HBase. So HBase is, think of that as a super fast real-time store. So common cases for HBase would be, like we use it in Skype. If you want to look up your call history, if you pull up any application and you say, I want to see all the calls I've made, when you click on that, you're actually pulling up HBase. Facebook uses HBase for its instant messaging platform. So when you're sending massive messages back and forth, they're persisted in an HBase store. So this is, think of this as really, really, really big tables with lots of columns doing super fast lookups. So you can do lookups over billions of rows in seconds using HBase. That's really what it's made for. So you could think of, what applications might I build that would use that. Anything that's really doing real-time processing, if you want to be able to do, if you want to have a dashboard that's doing lookups off of the real-time data as it comes in, HBase is a good solution for that. Data that's coming in off of like a car sensors or something like that, you could do lookups off of. Of course, it runs on top of HDFS, so it works with blob storage and it works with Azure Data Lake. And you can change the schemas any time as you go. And we'll do a deep dive on HBase in the second hour. All right, Storm is the next one. So this is for real-time streaming. So Apache Storm came from Twitter. So that's kind of the level of scale that it was built to handle. we've run it in our system processing millions of events per second, and we were not even close to being maxed out in terms of the number of cores we could throw at it. So I haven't yet seen a customer that had a scale problem with Storm in terms of how far that system can go. It's great for actually in real time processing the event. So if you want to perform action over data as it's coming in, so this is more the velocity portion of the big data world. If you want to perform action over that data as it comes in, Storm is a great way to do that. Storm lets you, it relies on the same computational infrastructure that the rest of Hadoop uses, so you can actually use the compute nodes to process all those events in a distributed way. It manages that distribution for you, so you're not thinking about, I'm sending an event here, an event there. You write your logic, your business logic over the events, and it will take care of basically ingesting and processing all of those events as they come through. You can write arbitrary business logic. You can write Java or C# code in those event handlers. So you could write events out to any source that you wanted. You could do any business logic, any lookups. You could tie into your existing logic if you wanted. in the context of Storm. So that's really where we talk about the difference between Storm and Stream Analytics. Stream Analytics is super easy, super productive. It has some limits in terms of the flexibility that you get. So if you're in the Hadoop ecosystem, Storm is a no-brainer. If you're not and you've never tried streaming before, Stream Analytics is a great place to start. So that's kind of the trade-off. I'll walk through this flow, actually. So this is a typical kind of a flow. If you've got data coming in, event producers, devices, and sensors. Oh, I got to stay in the camera over here. So that comes into like an event hub or a Kafka queue where you would store the events. And then you could, as Storm processes them, it would read out of those queues. And that gives you guaranteed, gives you reliability and guarantees on delivery of the data. You process it and perform actions, and then you might put it into various forms of storage depending on what you want to do with it later. Most solutions that I've seen that bring data in through something like Storm, they go through this cycle where they store, in addition to processing the data as it comes in, they store the data into something like Blob Storage or Azure Data Lake. And then as the data accumulates over time, they use that historical data to retrain the models that they then apply to real time. So basically, you get a system that can get smarter and smarter over time, because you can find more cases where, hey, our automatic predictive maintenance logic didn't catch the failure in this refrigerator. I've got a customer that's looking at instrumenting all of the freezers in all of their grocery stores around the world, and they want to make sure that they know before a freezer fails. I've got a customer that does, they build thousands of underwater submarines. They built the thing that was when the well in the Gulf got messed up. They built the device that was down there fixing the well head. And they've got telemetry coming off of these things all the time. And you want to know that that's going to fail well before it ever does, so you can fix it before it ever breaks. Replace the parts that are basically getting old before it breaks. And that's where you'd store that data, and then you train your models to say, all right, so we knew that the umbilical cord for the remote sub was going to break because the feedback off of this sensor actually starts to go below this threshold before it breaks, and that tells us that the cable's getting weak. That's the kind of thing you're looking for in those scenarios. And that's what Storm is really great for. And then on the other end, on the far side, people take the ingested and processed results of that data as it's come through and connect it up to their BI and their dashboarding tools. And we'll show you in the second session, we'll walk through an example of how you create a Storm application, create business logic, and then connect that up to Power BI and build a dashboard on it. All right. Spark. Spark is like this thing that everybody's excited about, but I don't know that anybody's really deployed into production yet, but everybody plays with, right, is what I keep hearing. And it's always, can I get the latest version? I swear, I've never seen a component where people wanted the latest version more than with Spark. Even if it doesn't run or falls over, I want it. That's been a lot of fun for us. Spark is great. It's got some great things to it, though. It's the core goal of Spark is speed. And it uses in-memory to do that. It uses a distributed in-memory architecture, so it will actually spread the data out in memory across the nodes that you're using. And that's great for a few key scenarios. One of them is data science. So it has a good connection in with notebooks, which give you an interactive experience. And I'll actually show you I think I've got a screenshot here of this is kind of what the notebook experience looks like. So you can actually type in code against the data as you go and run it and then see the results and then visualize the results and go back and change them and iterate on it that way if you want until you get the output that you like. And that's what is so compelling about it to data scientists is it lets them basically run these experiments iteratively, visualize the results, shape the data that they're working with, combine other data, and then share that with other scientists. So we see that as a really common thing for Spark. It also, we've done work to connect Spark up with the BI assets. So a really common pattern that we believe folks, we see folks wanting a lot is you ingest data in its raw form into the data lake, you process it using batch technologies, and then you want to do, you want to take the processed results and serve those up to a more interactive layer. Today we'll see people put that into SQL Server, for example, and then everybody can connect to SQL Server using their familiar analytic tools. The one drawback with that today is that, well, a couple of drawbacks. One is you have processing, multiple processing steps to get to that final output in the database. Another one, though, is that you lose granularity of the data. When you go from that raw data to the aggregated data, you have to make trade-offs, and because the relational store is not built to handle the scale that the batch system, that the Hadoop stack can handle. So one of the things that makes people really excited about Spark is it gives you interactivity at scale. So you could actually bring that data in, clean it up with batch, and then spin up a Spark node or a Spark cluster, connect it to the same data you've just processed, and then all of your analysts can still connect to the Spark cluster and get interactive query using the familiar query tools. And what we've done with this is we've worked with a number of the tool vendors that are listed here. Of course, we've also integrated this deeply into Power BI so that those tools actually have drivers built in that are available for free that connect and let you run those queries against Spark using things like Power BI and Tableau. And we actually also built integration into that experience so that it actually looks at the H catalog, which is the definitions you've made in batch, and the tables you've defined in batch will show up in the analytic tools. We flow that metadata all the way through to the tools. And that actually can also be something that the data scientists work with. So if I create those definitions in the notebook experience as a data scientist, I can also share those with analysts who can hit that and see the same definitions using the BI tools. So I said a lot, yeah, so I want to pause and ask if there are questions on this.
Apps like SAP, help me understand.
So this is SAP Lumira was the one. So that's an analytic tool. They would connect to, you know, imagine that most common thing I see with applications like SAP is you want to connect all your telemetry up with your customers or your, in this case, your employees. So if you had data that was, like, let's say that you... you know, if I use that example of the, we'll use a different one, like trucking, trucking company. I'll show you a demo in a minute of a trucking application. you've got your, you know who your employees are coming out of SAP. That's where all your employee records are. Then you've got all this telemetry coming off of the machinery that's out in the field. All the trucks are out on the road. So you're managing a whole fleet. You don't necessarily need to put, or you still want to use your SAP system, right? Because that's got all the logic built in that has knowledge of, in a structured way and rules around, all of your people. But you want to be able to connect that up with your telemetry that you're processing. So if you want to be able to say, where are all my trucks on the road? And that truck right there, who's driving that? And when you do that, that's actually ends up being a join between your SAP data and your telemetry data. Same thing happens with CRM systems, with customer, or other structured database systems with inventory or product catalog kind of joins.
So the way I look at it, Spark, query against SAP?
No, this is coming from, it's coming from SAP to Spark. So this would be going the other way. And in this case, SAP Lumira is an analysis tool. So it would be people who want to look at their SAP data, but they also want to look at their data lake, and Spark would give them an engine to be able to do that and then combine the data between the two. Any other questions on, yeah?
I think I get what you mean by notebook experience.
Yeah, so let me see if I've got, no. I'm going to resist the temptation to jump into demo mode. I know it's what you want me to do, but in the interest of time, demo, in the interest of time, I'm not going to yet, because that'll be an hour or two. But basically, it's a web page that, and we'll show it in the next hour from 1 to 2, but it's a web page that basically has a command window at the top, and you can type in SQL statements, you can type in machine learning algorithms, you can type in Python. There's a whole set of languages you can choose from that basically cause actions over the data that you're working with. And as you do that, those steps show up in sequence in the page. And so it's kind of like showing your homework. And you can actually go back and change any of the steps. And you can take the whole thing and share it with anybody else. And so it's great for exploratory analytics and collaboration around that. And you can also visualize the data right in the context of the web page. Good question, thanks. All right, I'm gonna keep moving along here. So here's a kind of a basic view. I just put a screenshot of what those pages look like. We'll drill in more in a bit, or actually later on. Another thing that we've invested in is making it so that Visual Studio is deeply integrated with these tools, with Hadoop. So we've actually, in the last update to the Azure SDK, we added this little guy over here, which is a graphical view of your job. So if you actually, if you write as gnarly of a query as you want to write with joins across all kinds of different files, and you want to look at the performance of that query, there's actually a graphical tree structure that we create and surface up into Visual Studio that you can use to look at where, how much time was spent in each node of computation, and maybe where some of the bottlenecks were. If there was a problem, if there's a particular join that's going very slow, that will help you to see and debug that. We've also built in IntelliSense, so you can type Hive right in. I think I've got this loaded up, so I will just show it really quick. this is probably hard for you to read, so don't try and read it. I'll we'll do a macro view of it. So I can see the clusters I have running. I can see the tables that are in those clusters. I can say I want to view the top 100 rows, and that will actually just queue up a job that shows me the results. I can right click on a particular table, or I can right click on a cluster, and I can say I want to write a Hive query. Let me make this a little bigger. So now I can say, let me zoom in a little more. Select star from. You can see I get IntelliSense, so it works just like SQL. Basically, if I've got a table over here, Hive sample table where, and I get statement completion, and then when I'm done, I can see where the where the execution time went, and how that job was processed. And to submit it, I can just pick the cluster that I want to run it against, and I can say submit. If I wanted to check the syntax, like if I have a syntax error, I can check that just by validating the script and run it locally, so I don't have to submit it to the server. Select from here. Probably thinks that's a table name. How? Anyway, we'll go into more depth on what we can do there. But basically, we've done a lot of work to make it so that you can access, you can work against Hadoop using these tools. And it's funny, when I first started working on this stuff a couple years ago, it felt like a trip back in time. It was like all of a sudden I was in the 1990s again, using really, really primitive tools and kind of peeking at text files and opening them up. And the only difference was you could open up massive files. You could work with massive data, but you couldn't connect Excel to it. You couldn't visualize it. You couldn't debug it with an IDE like Visual Studio. That's really what we've been focused on in this area, is making it so that this stuff is actually feels as mature. It's not there yet, but our goal is feels as mature as, say, a database, but scales to billions or trillions of rows. That's what we're doing here in terms of our tooling investment. We run both on Linux and on Windows. So a whole bunch of the innovation that happens in the Hadoop space is on Linux. And so we want the ability for people to take anything they get from the ecosystem and paste it in and not have to be worrying about converting it to PowerShell if you don't want to. If you want to use Bash or whatever, pick your tool of choice. If you want to do this from a Mac and just SSH in to the clusters, you can do that. It's all running on Linux. At the same time, if you want to run .NET and you want to use, or you have other Windows servers and you're familiar with that, then you can deploy it to Windows, so you choose. All right, another thing we're doing on, and we will drill into this as well in the second hour, but something we're doing on the Linux clusters in particular is we're certifying all of the applications in the Hadoop ecosystem to run and actually be easily installed, kind of like an app store experience into the cluster. So there are a lot of apps, just like any app ecosystem. There are a lot of apps. There are some really cool apps. There are a lot of dorky apps too. So just kind of, so we're starting with the coolest apps basically and getting them all certified into the system. So I'm going to show you three just to give you an example of what I'm talking about. So the first one is Datamere. So Datamere is a graphical application that lets you visually do data preparation. And that, as Jason was talking about in the last session, that's where people spend a ton of time, especially in big data, because the files can be unwieldy. So doing joins, cleaning, getting rid of columns, shaping the data, prepping it so that you can do further analysis is a common task that we all have to deal with. Datamere really nails that. And so you can, with just a few clicks, have a Datamere app up and running on your cluster. And you can serve that application out to your end users. And they don't even have to know they're dealing with Hadoop. For them, it just feels like kind of like a web-based Excel experience. So that's pretty cool. I think we'll look at that in detail in a little bit. Another one is Trifacta. These guys do a little more, these are aimed more at the data developer. So this is, they have good support for doing regular expressions to manipulate text at scale. They let you visualize the trends in the data as you're shaping it. And really then join other sources with it and enrich it. So this is a great experience for a data developer. And then the last one that I want to highlight here is AdScale. What these guys do is they actually build OLAP cubes on the data lake. So you can put AdScale on top of an HD Insight cluster, and they've implemented MDX and SQL. And so you can have petabytes of data sitting in your data lake, all surfaced up as a cube. And for your end users, if they go into Excel, all they have to do is say from analysis services and then enter in the address of the cluster and connect into them. It just feels like an SSAS cube. And it does dynamic creation of the aggregates and will serve them up fast. So it's a nice way to really accelerate big data, but not have to do giant processing to get to a cube from what you've got in the data lake. The data all just stays in the lake. I think we might be able to see that one too. All right, so now let's drill in on the Azure Data Lake. So this has been announced already. It's in private preview now. It's coming to public preview fairly soon. Let me know if you're interested in trying it out. My address is lanceo@microsoft.com. I'll say it again at the end, but feel free to send me mail if you have questions on any of what I'm covering here. So the data lake is, Azure Data Lake is a storage system built for big data processing. It's designed from the ground up with that in mind. Like Jason said, it actually comes from the internal system that we use to process all of the data that runs Microsoft. We operate on the scale of exabytes in this system today. We've proven this system out at massive scale. So I'm going to drill in on some of the key value props that you see here. One is it's native HDFS. So you can use web HDFS. So you can use any of the open source tools that work with HDFS can run on top of the data lake. And we're working with each of these partners to certify all of their distributions on top of it. So that's great. We did that because we want to leverage the ecosystem. We want you to be able to use that. It supports unlimited files and unlimited accounts. So you can put as much data as you want into it. My favorite thing about this is that when I put in when I put data in blob storage today, if I have enough data that I'm putting in that is going to overflow the limit of what I can put into one file or one storage account, I have to partition my data across multiple accounts, and then I have to actually change the way I write queries so that I take the partitions into account. So basically, as my data and my app grows, I have to do refactoring to ensure I get the right kind of scale and performance. We can help you with that. We can give you guidance on how to do it. It's all possible, and I have lots of customers that do it. It is extra work, and it's extra complexity that shows up in your app. With the data lake, I can write my code on day one, and on day 1,000, let's say I didn't perfectly get my partitioning scheme right, and I have hotspots where some data has grown way more than the other partitions. It doesn't matter because we don't have limits on how big the files are. You can just keep going, and your app doesn't have to change because the system underneath you will scale. And so that's a key benefit that really future-proofs your app, the investment you make in writing your code such that it scales, and you don't have to refactor it to get that scale. So we have a wide variety of applications running on top of this system internally. We have over 100 million devices connected to the system that we run of this technology internally. Think of every Xbox on the planet writing data into this system. Think of Windows devices and Office devices and basically everything that we do in being in our online properties, all writing into the system. We put the entire web into this system in Microsoft to power Bing. So it sees a lot of data. It sees a lot of big data. So you have dials that let you control the throughput that you get on the data. You can write massive amounts of data in. To do that in blob storage today, you end up having to partition across the accounts once again because each account has throughput limits, and if you want to maximize throughput, you have to basically max it out across all the partitions that you're managing. With a data lake, we take care of all that for you, and so you get that throughput without having to mess with the partitioning. All right, and then along the same lines is low latency. So sometimes you want to write a lot of data fast. Other times you want to do a lot of small writes. So in device scenarios, if you have 100 million devices connected into a system and you're logging small writes for every one of those devices, you may not actually run into a throughput limit, but you may run into an operations limit, like how many IOPS, how many reads or writes can you perform, and how fast can you perform them. And so we also have dials built into the system for latency that lets you crank the latency way down and tune it for systems that are writing large numbers of writes or reads into the system. And then, of course, it's integrated with security. So it's integrated in with Active Directory. So you can use roles and users to do folder and file level ACLs on top of any of the data. So you can take a petabyte file and right-click on it and say, this data, I want to make it read-only to all of my business users, and I want to make it read-write to all of my developers so that they can write code that processes batch and then updates that data set, but the business users can't mess with it when they hit it with their tools. They can just use it for their own input into the analysis they're doing, and I can trust that they don't have access to write back and change the shape of it if that's what I want. All right, so I'm gonna pause again and just ask, are there any questions? I covered a lot of stuff, yeah.
So can I say data lake would be more of a customized group? Because you said data lake, in the earlier session, it was mentioned that data lake also is based on XDFS. So is it a very custom?
Yeah, so the way to think of it is, so the question is data lake a customized version of Hadoop? And data lake is a massive storage engine that we built internally for our own purposes to run things like Bing and Windows and Xbox. And we decided that we wanted to make that available as something that everybody could use. So it, in the core implementation, it's not coming straight out of the Apache Hadoop. But what we did is we made the interfaces for Data Lake be HDFS compliant so that it supports the Hadoop ecosystem. So think of that more as an interface contract. Yes, in the back there.
How is it different from Azure Data Warehouse?
How is it different from what? From Azure Data Warehouse. So the Azure Data Lake is just a store. So you bring the compute layer separately. So think of it as a storage system for read and write and throughput and things like that. It's more of a, if you think back when I was talking about the data lake is where you put all the data, then you bring compute to the data. Whereas a relational store or like Azure Data Warehouse or SQLDB, you have the storage and you have the data together. And there's a very specific compute layer that you use on top of that store. In the very back.
Can you choose where to geographically store it?
Yes, so can you choose where to geographically store it? It works a lot like Azure Blob Storage, where you pick the region. Yeah?
You were talking about security earlier. Is
row-level
security supported?
Yeah, so the question is row-level security supported? So the data lake itself support security on files and folders. So there's no concept of a row at that level. With that level of support in the store, that enables us to put row level security at a higher layer, which is something we're working on, but it's not in there yet.
So would a tool like AtScale kind of mimicking a cube, does it support row level security, do you know?
I don't know if AtScale supports row-level security. I do have partners I didn't show here. One of them is called Blue Talon that we've certified that do support row-level security. So we can do row-level security in the system. We can actually do row-level security. We can do data masking. We can do all kinds of policy around security and transformations and access to the data with those systems. But today I do that through the partners.
One of the problems with the data lake is trying to find your favorite phishing hole and across other phishing holes, right?
Yeah.
Is there going to be any integration with the data catalog?
Ooh, great question. Yeah, that's a setup. I should have a slide for that next or something, right? Is there going to be integration with the data catalog? Yeah, so we're definitely looking at, as we create these assets, loading them into the data catalog as kind of the central repository for all of the metadata that you access here. And that's a key focus for us.
And do you expect to have like public versions of the data in the data lake that would be available, similar to like what AWS does? You know, we have some big data.
Public data sets.
Yeah,
that's certainly something that we are taking into account as we bring this out. Data that is like, you know, genome data or other data that we think most people would want. If there are data sets that you have in mind in particular, just mail them to me and I'd love to hear about them. Yeah?
So when you talk about a data lake holding folders and files.
Yeah.
If you ultimately get down to like a row store or relational, does a file represent, would that be a server? Would it be a database? Would it be a table? Would it be a row? What sort of concept would you treat a file as?
Think of a file as the data underneath a table is probably where I would come in at with it. And then we will do, like we're adding, like with things like Blue Talon and work that we're doing to add more security into the Hadoop layer, you will actually have, you imagine you'd have a table that you define on top of a file. And you can have table, which would almost be like a view. So it's almost like kind of table versus view level security. Okay. Yeah?
That's the concept of being able to schematize, basically conceptually schematize it within ADL? You can schematize data once you ingest it in, right?
Yeah, so schematizing happens above the store. So it happens in the compute layer and in the metadata system with things like the data catalog. In the case of Hadoop, it happens in the H catalog. So I would do like a create external table, and then I would point to a URL that holds the ADL data. Yeah, in the back there.
How do you replicate data lake?
Yeah, replication's built in. It works just like replication in Azure Blob Storage. So you can set it up to do geo-replication to, you know, a region that's within your geopolitical compliance boundary, I think is the official way to say it. Yeah. Yeah. We have, I mean, I think everything will run into a limit at some point. We have dramatically higher throughput and IOP limitations than what we have today in the system with blob storage. They're high enough that we process exabytes of data in them today with hundreds of millions of devices connected to them. So they're high, and the latency can be very low. But I don't have the absolute numbers. Maybe in the session tomorrow we can talk. I've got Rajesh, who's the GPM for the data lake, will come in and we'll do 40 minutes on the data lake. So actually, I need to wrap up here in just a minute. So I'll hold on the questions for now, on any further questions, and I'll be outside in the hall afterwards. So just to wrap up, I want to hit a few things on what to do next. I'll share these slides out. I've got a number of great real-world scenarios of how customers are using the system. Nudesic is a great example. These guys had an on-prem batch processing system that was reading off of electrical meters to power one of the states here in the U.S., and it was costing them around $1 million a year to process data in that data warehouse. And each run took about 14 hours a day, which means if they had a run fail, they may actually never be able to catch up, depending on when the RAN fell, if they could kick it off before they hit 24 hours. They built a scheme with us that basically separated the customer data out from the data that was coming off of the metered homes and pushed all of that up into HD Insight. What they're able to do now is it takes, they don't even use a very big cluster. I think it's like an 8-node cluster. So it could be, they could go dramatically faster if they wanted. It takes less than an hour a day to run the entire job that was taking 14 hours on their on-prem data warehouse. And it costs them about $10,000 a year compared to $1 million. For that system. So that is an example of the kind of change, order of magnitude change in cost, and almost more importantly, in time to insight that you get with these scale-out systems. And if anybody's interested, I can give you it's Nudesic, I can give you their contact information if you want to go talk to them about how they did it. I will send out these slides. I have links to the key verticals that we're focused on in Cortana Analytics with some of the industry trends and common scenarios that we see. I'll just scroll through them here so you can read them, and then I'll go outside and we can talk more about them if you'd like. Number of customer, the service has been running for about over a year and a half now, so we actually have a lot of interesting customers. This is like such an exciting space to me because on one day we can be talking to somebody about, you know, the recorded human history. On another day it's genome therapy. On another day, it's oil wells deep in the ocean or up in the up in the snow. Folks are doing all kinds of really cool, interesting things with big data, and we have a lot of cases. Like Ziosk was kind of a fun one. They track every button that a customer touches in one of those interactive menus in 77,000 different devices they have in restaurants around the United States. And they use the back-end big data systems to serve up views on what food people like and how they're interacting with the menus of the restaurants. Healthcare is another really big one, and so we see a lot of activity happening in the healthcare space with these systems. I want to reduce errors in patient care. I want to reduce cases where patients have to come back. Financial services is another one. Of course, fraud, minimizing trading risk and investment risk. Okay, so what to do next? So there's part two. I would invite you to part two. That's where we'll go deep on each of the pieces. There are very few slides in that session. It's almost all just working with the services. And then tomorrow, there from 10 to 12 in Hood, there is Azure Data Lake, Apache Spark, and Data Catalog. So with that 2 hours, we'll go through all three of those things in depth. That's why I didn't cover Spark as deeply here. And then there are links to the slides in terms of where you can go to read more. There's a learning map that kind of helps you to know where to get started so you can pick the topic that makes sense to you. And that's it. Thanks for coming. I'll be outside if you have any questions. Have a good day. And hope to see you back in an hour or so. Have a good lunch.